Oddly enough, last Thursday, I'm an inveterate dial switcher, and I happened to be dial switching on my radio, FM radio, and I picked up a little FM station, must be a college station, and I heard you. And there was a young man who was playing, he was playing some of the Jelly Roll stuff and interviewing you.
Uh-huh. Wonder what station this could have been.
I can't remember the call letters, and it was a college FM station. You must have been live. Were you live last Thursday night?
Well, last Thursday night I recall I was over in...
Before you were going to be getting together with me.
That's right. It was in Newark. It wasn't a college station. It was the jazz station over there, W-something. But I was with James Brown, the music person there who has a deep involvement in jazz and black culture.
So I heard most of it, and I figure that it'd be hard for me to ask you much more than what you covered there, but you will at least have a different audience. So there are a lot of things I want to ask you about.
Fine.
I also photocopied this. It was a nice interview with you.
Yes, she did a very nice job. She's from the 60s and understood a lot of where I was coming from. So,
before I ask you some questions about yourself, I'd like for you to tell me about Jelly Roll Morton. You seem to have caught his way of speaking pretty well. Were there tapes or was there any information available that helped you to capture his voice in the way you did?
Well, Jelly made those marvelous series of recordings for the Library of Congress in the spring of 1938 with Alan Lomax. And typical of what the kind of person Jelly was, he recognized that this was his opportunity to make his statement. So instead of just doing a few songs and playing the piano a little, he began talking and reciting and narrating and telling the story of the world and his life and jazz as he remembered it. And there was an awful lot of material recorded, and it was finally edited into 12 LPs by Harriet Janis, the wife of Sidney Janis, the art dealer, and it was put out on a little label, Circle Records, by Rudy Blesch. And they had enough courage when they did it to not just put out the piano solos and the ragtime and the tangos. They let Jelly talk. And this is where I got the flavor of the language. So I did a lot of work. I mean, I grew up with those records. I grew up hearing Jelly's voice. When I was a lonely teenager, I listened to Jelly Roll Morton. And so his voice is, I think, just part of my own voice. And when I went back to write about him, I simply returned to those marvelous documents he had made with his own voice and his own way of presenting himself, a mixture of braggadocio and humility and honesty and down-home country language and an attempt to use big words that he sometimes didn't quite get right.
It's obvious you feel strongly about Jelly Roll Morton. I understand that you had contemplated doing a biography.
Well, this is right. Both my wife and I have done biographies. She did the first biography of the black entertainer Burt Williams, who had been the first one to break the color barrier onto the stage at the Ziegfeld Follies. And then working together, she did the biography of Jack Kerouac, the beat writer. And then we collaborated and did a biography of a anti-Soviet poet, Vladimir Mayakovsky, who ran afoul of Stalin and shot himself in 1930. So we'd had three family biographies. So publishers, agents said to us, you love Jelly Roll Morton. There's need for a big biography of Jelly Roll. So I began. I went to Louisiana again, talked to family again. I gathered materials again. And then I realized, no, what I really want with Jelly, I want the stories about his girlfriends. I want to know what he thought about things. I want to hear his outrageous opinions. And the rest of it, all those day-to-day details that a biographer is responsible for, I thought I'd leave that to somebody else.
There's some dramatic episodes in Jelly Roll's life. For example, can you tell us about the race riots in New Orleans?
This was such a crucial moment in Jelly's life. If you can imagine, Jelly was of that black group that were of mixed blood. And in New Orleans, up until about 1894, about the middle of this group, calling themselves the Creoles, they had special privileges, and they didn't have to conform to all the restrictions of segregation. They could sit anywhere on the bus, and they could go anywhere, and they could work jobs. Then in 1894, they found themselves pushed into this situation where they were simply being herded along with everyone else. And Jelly was 9 when this happened. And then in the summer of 1900, there was a very complicated instance of a black man named Robert Charles who simply resented being pushed along by the police. He was sitting with a friend waiting to meet his sister at a place where she was working. They were sitting at night. Because she worked in a white home, they were sitting on the stoop outside a white home. And the police came, and without really stopping to find out what these two men were doing there, they actually began beating Robert Charles. And Robert Charles was a big man who had run into difficulties with the police before. So he went out into the middle of the street, and there was an exchange. He and a policeman exchanged shots. Charles was wounded. So he fled to his little apartment, the little shack where he was living, realizing that he'd shot at a policeman, so there was no way he was going to escape alive. So he simply waited for the police to come, and he killed the first two police who came. And that was in the middle of the night. And when the news hit the New Orleans streets, New Orleans just blew up. Here, a black man had taken a rifle and cold-bloodedly shot the chief of police through the heart and shot the next policeman dead. So the town for 3 days. I said, really, in the book, it was as though at Mardi Gras, that moment when the cannon goes off at midnight and everyone takes off their masks. Whatever anyone thought about race relations in New Orleans, suddenly it was all stripped away, all the hypocrisy, all the true emotions came forth. The next night, white mobs simply raged through the town, taking blacks off streetcars, any black they could find. The white mobs raged through the red light district, Storyville, and there was the man who was leading the first jazz orchestra, Buddy Bolden, was playing a little dance hall. They just escaped with their lives. The prostitutes were out on the doorways and shouting on to the mob to go kill the niggers. And it went on until Friday when finally they did corner this man, Robert Charles, and he went down fighting. He managed to kill 5 more men and wounded a lot of others before he went. And the mob was so enraged with him that even after he was dead, they dragged his body out into the street and just pounded it to a pulp and then dragged it behind a police wagon back. And there continued to be rioting for the next 3 days. They burned most of the black schools. They simply, any places that employed blacks, they burned these. So whatever feelings Jelly may have had about New Orleans, about his life, he sentimentalized about it a lot when he was older, but he never went back.
Tell me about Jelly Roll Morton, the musician, and how he started.
Jelly Roll was from this Creole group, and they were a marvelously musical, cultured group that had prided themselves on really carrying on a musical tradition of the French side of their background. Jelly was unique as a young boy in that he wouldn't renounce the other side of his background. He was very proud of the black heritage of music, as well as the musicality and the opera and the symphonies of the Creole society. There was a Creole opera house, and they had quadrilles, balls, and they played very formal music very well. But Jelly, at the same time, he couldn't resist the honky-tonks. He couldn't resist the barrelhouse music he was hearing. He couldn't resist the blues. And his family remembers him just spending all his days playing the piano. He started on the guitar, and then he discovered that the piano was his instrument.
Self-taught?
There were a number of masters. He did study with one of the Creole professors, so he had enough music theory to write his own arrangements and to score the solos, which played such a prominent part in the music he was to record in the 1920s. So he was rather well educated as a musician. Even though he was not music school, he had had formal training with, I think, Professor Nickerson, one of the formal Creole teachers there. He'd worked hard. And yet at the same time, if there was any kind of new music, any kind of excitement, new song, he was there listening to it. Sadly enough, it led to him being cast out by his family shortly after the Robert Charles riot. It was a family that was very proper and wouldn't permit a child of theirs to hang around the red light district. His mother and father had died. He was with his grandmother. And she simply said, "You have 2 younger sisters, and you'll be a bad influence." So there he was on his own, with nothing but the piano and his pool playing between him and starvation. It was a hard, tough world, but he made it.
He had a peripatetic existence. He landed in Mexico and many other places. What Was Jelly Roll's life like after he left New Orleans?
He was a wanderer. I must say that, as I said in the book about Jelly, I don't think that he ever called any place really home again. When he went back in his dreams and memories, it was always New Orleans. He lived any place where there was a job. He was in Los Angeles for a while. He was in Chicago for a while. He was in New York for a while. And all the years in between, he was wandering around playing with any kind of job he could get. He toured with the theaters. He fancied himself a stage comedian, though, as one musician said, Jelly Roll was as funny as a sick baby. But he thought he was enormously funny, and he had a tramp piano act that he toured with. And occasionally he would think himself home for a while, Los Angeles, in those early days, in the early days of film and the early days of jazz, all growing up together and out in Hollywood. But then it got too small, and he moved on, and he thought Chicago would be it. Then in the 20s, Chicago was wide open, but then Chicago began to feel a little small. So then New York, and even New York was finally too small for Jelly Roll's talents.
Let me ask you a couple questions about yourself. Looking across from the title page, also by Samuel Charters, you have poetry, fiction, criticism, translations, books about music. Where do you find time to do all this? That's a lot of books to turn out.
Well, I've had a very wonderful opportunity with my life. I am a record producer, and I produce rock and roll records. And the companies that I've worked with have all understood that I need time to write. So they've simply made an arrangement that if I'm not actually in the studio with a group, fine, just come by once a week and check on the mail. And they rather like the books, too. And so for the last 25 years, I've had an arrangement where I could leave the solitary, lonely, hard labor of the writing and the typewriter and go into the recording studio and just be part of the musical life.
Now you're turning to fiction now more frequently. Mr. Jabby and Mr. Smythe.
That's right.
I pronounced that correctly?
That's right.
And now, of course, Jelly Roll Morton. And so apparently you're turning away from some of the nonfiction so that you can do the...
That's right. That's exactly it. I've had such excitement from the music in my life. It's given me so much, the black music, the blues, the jazz. And I really wanted to write about it. And I felt that I would do that first. And then I could turn to my own creativity, my own novels. And the time has come. So I'm going to be doing that almost exclusively from now on.
You feel very strongly about black people, don't you?
I grew up in a family that loved jazz. They were sort of fans, that kind of prep school fandom in the 20s, loving jazz and following the bands. My uncles would disappear, and it turned out they'd hitchhike to New York to see Duke Ellington's latest trumpet player. They'd come back and tell me about Rex Stewart at the Cotton Club. And I assumed everyone was growing up with this kind of knowledge and response to the music. And then when I first went south in 1950 to play music in New Orleans with a young jazz musician, then the shock of segregation hit me. And things which I had been shielded from, in a way, growing up as I did a middle-class life, I hadn't seen the realities of the ghetto. I hadn't seen the placards which said where blacks had to sit. I hadn't been to the hospitals where there were two entrances for white and black. I reacted strongly to it and spent a number of years. I'm too shy to be politically active, and I could never make speeches, and I could never lead any kind of movement. So instead I wrote my books, and this was my way.
Well, I grew up in the 1940s in Houston, Texas. And we would go to the zoo, and there would be a drinking fountain, two drinking fountains, one labeled colored, the other white, side by side. Everybody knew that black people sat in the back of the buses in Houston, and they always sat in the balcony of the movie theaters. We didn't know that was wrong. That was a way of life that Styron, who also, William Styron, feels very strongly about the civil rights issue, but he never knew that it was wrong. Mm-hmm. Segregation was wrong and inherently evil. The whole South, generations of people grew up year after year accepting that as just a way of life.
I think if I hadn't come to it as an outsider, If I'd grown up with it, it might have seemed more natural. But coming to it just as I did, just suddenly being, you know, suddenly on the first trains going to the South in those years, being conscious of the Jim Crow cars, that suddenly the train would stop and all the black passengers sitting around me would get up and go to a separate car in the back. And I remember 18, 19 years old for the first time following them and seeing the car they were being forced to sit in. And it certainly wasn't as good as the car they'd been forced to leave. So absolutely, if you had grown up with it, and then it would not have seemed. But for me, just coming down for the first time, I used to play music in the bars in New Orleans with some of the black bands, and the police would come and take me away, and they would haul me up and accuse me of reckless driving. And I'd say I was playing the piano, and they'd say, "That's reckless driving, and don't you do it again." So I also became aware of official hypocrisy. I was suddenly thrust into a whole lot of things for which I had no preparation. A whole legal system slanted, a whole system of government slanted, and it was a lot of years before I felt I'd said enough about it.
Where did you grow up?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, until I was about 15, and then Sacramento, California.
Where were you educated?
I got my bachelor's at the University of California in economics, but I went to high schools in Pittsburgh and in California, which were integrated. And
what high school were you in Pittsburgh?
Peabody High School.
I went to Aspinwall.
Oh, well, then you know it very well. Aspinwall was there right near the Boy Scout camp, Guyasutu, where I used to go.
That's right, there was a Boy Scout.
That's right, I used to walk out there, spend all my weekends there.
Why did you go to Sweden?
It was directly a result of the Vietnam War. There was just a point where I felt I didn't want to be associated any longer with the society that was waging that war. In the 60s, I had been involved in the protest movement. As a rock and roll record producer, I was working with Country Joe and the Fish, and we had made a very specific stand against the war with the song Fixin' to Die Rag. And finally, after the Kent State killings, the country, as you know, erupted in 1970, and I felt the time had come for me to make a decision. And there were two neutral countries at that point, Sweden and Switzerland, and I had been to Sweden the year before with Country Joe, so Sweden it was. So I moved there with my family and started all over again as an immigrant, and had to learn the language and begin absolutely at the bottom. It was a marvelous experience in many ways, just that experience, what I learned about myself and about societies and how it is to come in at the bottom.
Do you still live there?
I'm on my way back. I'm supposed to leave tomorrow morning. We've had a large house in Stockholm, and my wife is a university professor and could not find a position at her level in Sweden. So she teaches at the University of Connecticut. And we have two children who, on the whole, prefer America. So we have a home in Sweden and a home in Connecticut. And I go back and forth, and I've been here now for 5 months, which is a rather long time, and on my way back.
Have you abandoned your American citizenship?
It's a little difficult to go back and forth quite so easily if I were a Swedish citizen because of American immigration laws. So I have maintained my American citizenship, but I have a residence permit in Sweden, so there's no problem where I go.
How do you produce rock and roll records in Sweden?
Sweden, of course, has they had ABBA, which was a huge seller, and they have certainly the same range of music that we have here, only, of course, it's a much smaller country, only 8 million people. It's smaller than New York City. But for years I've been working with a wonderful group that's a mixture of West Indian and African musicians and a couple of Swedish musicians, and we're trying to put together a music which is politically conscious, but involves third world rhythms and blues rhythms and jazz.
Do you believe the time will ever come that you will forgive your native land?
Oh, I absolutely was an angry man when I left. Angry and felt futile and frustrated. But I wasn't alone in these feelings. And the American people, very shortly thereafter, forced Nixon to resign and forced an end to the war. I couldn't ask for more than that. But I have found a way of life in Sweden which is very satisfactory. Sweden has a wonderful culture. It's a wonderful place to live. So I stay in Sweden now because I enjoy it.
Well, how do they treat you? You said you had to start all over, and I would find it terrifically difficult to go to a land unless you had contacts there where you didn't know anybody. You say you couldn't speak the language?
You can imagine being a record producer like I am, and you sit there in the studio, and you're working with a singer, and he sings something for you, and you go out and you say to him, well, man, like, part of that got it, but we did the second verse. In Sweden, I didn't understand a word that they were singing. So it was as though I were trying to play volleyball with one hand tied behind my back or something. So it really was an incredible challenge. I had a part-time job with a Swedish record company, and they simply left me to sink or swim. And because there is such an interest in America and in American music, as you saw, there are a long list of books. A lot of people there had already read my books. So within a few months, we'd met a lot of people. And so we have a very rich cultural life. We're involved very much in Swedish music. I wrote in Swedish the first book on Swedish folk music. I participate in a lot of cultural activities in
Sweden. You wrote in Swedish?
Yeah, so I now can do both.
Fast learner.
Well, it's been I've been there now many years.
Yeah. Well, the Swedes strike me as rather taciturn and not as forward as Americans. And harder to get to know. Has that been your experience?
It's funny. I share some of the same temperament that Swedes have. We're both General Swedes and myself. We're very idealistic and a little shy. So often with strangers, we are very quiet and trying to be as proper as we can think of. And since Swedes recognized this in me and I recognize this in them, I've never had so many friends in my life. And there is a secret life that the Swedish society has, a secret culture which outsiders don't get a look at. And I just immediately fell in love with that side of Sweden. I must say most people who come to Sweden see the other side. When I went there were the deserters. There were 500 American deserters. For all the world clamor about them, you would have thought there were 5,000, but there were only 500 of them. And as I was there watching, just month by month, they all slipped away. They found it uncongenial. I don't think there's anyone left. I don't know any Americans in Sweden. All my friends are Swedish. Many people find it difficult.
Did you read a novel called, I believe it's called The People's Republic of Antarctica? I'm trying to think of the author's name. But this deals with a dramatic voyage among the generations of former draft dodgers who had gone to Sweden and are now setting sail and establish a new nation in Antarctica. And this was this writer had even foreseen the war in the Falkland Islands because they moved.
That's right.
It's very imaginative. Yeah. You would probably like that.
I remember the name.
To remember the fellow's name. Well, my last question to you is, what's ahead? Gosh, you've got so many books here, you have to add a couple of more to the list.
Oh, absolutely. There is a new novel called Frank Lewis's Son, and it's set in western Louisiana in the black society there. I've been working a lot with the music called Zydeco music, a strange west Louisiana mixture of blues and accordion music and Cajun and everything with the black musicians there. So I've had the last 10 years a very deep involvement with that society. So Frank Lewis's Son deals with that, and hopefully that'll be out early next year. And I think that with that, it's time for me to deal with my own life as a white person and my own society. So the writing I'm doing now, another novel, is it's about this life, which is something else that I know rather well.
I hope when your new novel comes out, you'll come back to CBS and talk to us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Very much to have you back.
Right.
Thank you very much. Hang on. Just one second.